This is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Libby Turner-Roman, and today we will be talking about The Empress of Salt and Fortune. I was trying to clean and reorganize my bookshelves the other day. I had good intentions of whipping through the task, but got completely sidetracked, discovering books that probably hadn't seen the light of day forever. One forgotten book, Uppity Women, called to me, and it was so much fun rereading it, and that was the end of organizing shelves. Forgotten people, forgotten things, forgotten histories have power when attention is paid to them. The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Nai Vo is a ravishingly beautiful tale of the triumph of silenced, overlooked, and nameless people over an imperialistic empire. The story runs 118 pages and so is technically really a novella. However, there's a lot going on in those pages. Murder, exile, betrayal, romance, love, revenge, horror, shady dealings, resilience, rebellion, the power of beauty and friendship, and the quiet rage of women. The Empress of Salt and Fortune tells the tale of an exiled empress who takes her revenge on her violent imperialistic husband and the patriarchal court system that underpins him by the use of clever and subversive tactics. The story is told in a non-linear style, weaving two timelines, the present and the distant past. It's really many fragmented stories, remembrances within a story, if you like. It's quite a complex tale, which initially appears fairly simple, but as you listen and read the tale, you begin to understand its marvellous complexity and depth. It's, in terms of genre, it's a fantasy fiction with LGBT characters. The story is told in a gentle and unhurried way. The book is divided into 12 unequal but short chapters, and all the chapters except three begin with a description of several items that Che, a historian and cleric, uncovers at the former residence, or prison really, of the Empress In Yu. Vo's world building is modelled on the politics and culture of Imperial China and Southeast Asia. The story of the Empress of Salt and Fortune takes place in a mythical and mystical empire called En, where birds talk, ghosts roam, and magicians control the weather to create perpetual summer. An has slaughtered, subjugated, and annexed the Northern Kingdom peoples and their land. The Northern Kingdom is a land of bracing cold, seals, and giant mammoths. An uses its weather magicians to change the climate of the north to summer so many of their mammoths sicken and die. The Emperor of Pine and Steel and An society view the northern people as savages. At the beginning of the book, Empress In Yu has been dead a year after ruling En for 54 years. Che, a non-binary travelling cleric, and their sidekick, a sassy talking hopo bird called Almost Brilliant, are from the abbey at Singing Hills. They're travelling to the capital to record the new empress's first dragon court and the eclipse. Singing Hills Abbey is a historical depository. The monks and the hopo birds collect and record the history of En. They see historical collection as a sacred trust. Che and Almost Brilliant work together. Che's job is to listen, and Almost Brilliant remembers like a recorder. They encounter the ghost of the late Empress's palanquin. Che and Almost Brilliant decide to stop at Scarlet Lake and the Palace of Thriving Fortune, since information about the late Empress has been declassified and the magic hiding the home that she was exiled in has been lifted. The historian in Che wants to go to the palace before the looters get there. They encounter an elderly lady, Rabbit, so nicknamed because of her two large front teeth, at the palace, who tells them the story of the Empress's In Yu's exile and subsequent victory. Rabbit's loyalty are to people now dead, and even though it could tarnish the memory of the old empress and make things difficult for the new empress, it's important that Che understand that she's not telling a story per se, but rather is telling Che, the historian, what he needs to understand to make sense of the record. She ends each portion of the story with the phrase, "Do you understand?" At first, Che and we don't understand, but by the end, both Che and we do understand. Rabbit was sent to the palace as an indentured servant when she was 5 by her province as a part of a tax payment to the emperor. She was a stand-in for the missing 5 caskets of orange dye the province couldn't pay. Rabbit works herself up from mopping the floors to being a servant of the inner house at the palace, basically the harem. Inyo, the northern princess, is married to an emperor, the Emperor of Pine and Steel, as part of an alliance deal. Her brother's been killed by the emperor's troops the year before. Inyo is alone in An, a foreigner with a dark skin in a strange land with people who think of her as a savage. They are both simultaneously afraid of her and disdainful and contemptuous of her. Inyo's only job is to have an heir. Rabbit is there with other 200 veiled servants to greet the new empress when she first arrives at the palace. Page 24. History will say that she was an ugly woman, but that's not true. She had a foreigner's beauty, like a language we do not know how to read. She was barely taller than I was at 10 and built like an ox drover's daughter. Her 2 long braids hung over her shoulders as black as ink, and her face was as flat as a dish and almost perfectly round. Pearl-shaped, they call it, where she came from, but piggish is what they called it here. She walked past with a spine like one of those birch trees, and she wore this dress, which is as white today as it was then. The seal that the dress was made from was killed by her brother on his first hunt. Patient as the unending ice itself, he stalked it for days at the breathing holes where they came up, and when it rose, it was as large as a man. The toggle is one of its teeth, carved by her uncle. Her brother and uncle, whose names are now only spoken in the mortuary halls of Inscrus, was killed just a year before at the Battle of Coenamfords. She would bring with her a wealth of salt, bushels of pearls, and enough whale oil to keep the palace alight for 20 years or more. One of the finest dowries ever to come to an emperor, but that was still a week away. When she first came to the Palace of Gleaming Light, Inyo was alone and empty-handed, wearing a splendid seal fur dress that the ladies of the women's quarters could only call strange and barbaric. She never wore this dress again at the palace, but when the emperor sent her into exile, she asked me to pack it carefully. I was 13 then, and it was my job to look after it. I packaged it so carefully between layers and layers of crisp paper, and every 10 days I brought it out to brush away any possible moth, egg or larvae. Even though there was a fashion for seal fur in the capital when Inyo became the empress in truth, there was never a dress like this once again. There never could be. It is beautiful, but every stitch bites into her history, the deaths she left behind and the home she could not return to. Do you understand? Rabbit realizes that Inyo is just a lonely, heartbroken girl. Rabbit decides that she'll make sure Inyo will never be lonely again. She tells Che that being close to Inyo was like being warmed by a bonfire and that she had been cold for a very long time. In the harem, Inyo learns board and dice games like Moon Lady Ship. She wants to know where she can get other similar games. She's told that the women who sell the games and tell fortunes travel up and down the coast all the time. Even though some of the other accessory wives treat Inyo with disdain, Inyo doesn't hate them, since hate is reserved for equals, and she knows she has no equal in all the empire. A pregnant Inyo becomes obsessed with fortune-telling. The whole capital mocks her because she is obsessed with and associates with fortune-tellers and low-class people. The emperor gives Inyo a solid necklace, it's more like a dog tag actually, for incubating the future prince. On Rabbit's recommendation, Inyo commissions the queer artist Yen Lan to create something else from the distasteful necklace. Inyo and Yen Lan spend a lustful, emotional and laughter-filled night together. Rabbit serves as a guard outside the chambers. Yen Lan creates a mammoth with the necklace It's a beautiful mammoth that Che finds at Thriving Fortunes. As soon as Inyo gives birth, her baby boy is taken away from her. She never even gets to hold him. The court surgeons perform a hysterectomy to make sure that Inyo can't have any more sons to compete with the new prince. Inyo cries and cries. Rabbit gets into bed with Inyo to hold and comfort her. The emperor sends a symbolic bundle tied with Inyo's mother's hair. It lets Inyo know that her mother is dead and that she will be exiled now that she served her function and given the emperor his heir. Che tells Rabbit that at the abbey they burn trash. That evening, Rabbit and Che burn the symbolic bundle the emperor sent the Empress Inyo 60 years ago. That night, Che dreams of Inyo's brother and mother waiting for her return in the north. Inyo asks Rabbit to come with her in exile. Scarlet Lake is actually near Rabbit's home, but Rabbit doesn't want to visit her family because she's still ticked off about being sent as part of a tax package. I can totally see her point. They name their prison palace Thriving Fortune. The minister of the left comes periodically, bringing along court women who have fallen out of favour to serve as spies. Mostly, Inyo and Rabbit ignore them. Kazu, an accessory wife, is the only one who gets close to them. She teaches them a new board games and tells them about fortune tellers who travel to all the aristocratic families in the capital. Kazu is very unlucky in the games, but Inyo is very, very lucky. Kazu grows fond of the empress, and that, ultimately, is her downfall. When the minister of the left comes to collect Kazu, she is reluctant to leave. Page 65. She was the only girl who ever cried when the minister of left returned to bring her back to the palace, and when she asked to stay, he frowned at her, his mouth turning into the slash of a sharp knife through the scraped hide. Of course, your love for the empress does you credit. Perhaps in a year or two when you may be spared from court. I felt a cold and heavy stone settle in my stomach at his words. But Kazu brightened up considerably. Well, a year or so, that's not so bad. Then I'll be back and I'll have all sorts of games to play from the capital. Won't I, Inyo? Won't I, Rabbit? Oh, you stupid girl. I can't stand to hear you prattle. Inyo turned impatiently to the minister of the left, even as Kazu looked at her with hurt in her bright eyes. Do not send her back. She will not stop talking or gaming, and you can be sure she does not do her chores. The two other girls nodded wisely, and the two girls the minister had brought to replace them with made quiet notes to themselves that the empress did not care for chatter. Kazu dropped like a poplar in drought, and even as Inyo turned around as if the matter bored her, I watched the minister. His eyes slid between the empress and Kazu and back again. I could see the grim math being worked there, even if Kazu could not. Finally, he tucked his hands into his sleeves and nodded. I will endeavour to select better when next I am called upon to choose maidens for your home, my empress. Inyo shrugged, as if the matter was dull to her, and she never looked up to watch Kazu leave with the minister or the other two girls, whose names we had never bothered to learn. Years later, Inyo tried to find Kazu, looking with both the chroniclers and the executioners who kept their own secret records. Neither scholar nor killer could remember Kazu. There was a record of her in the Registry of Accessory Wives when she first entered the Palace of Gleaming Light, and a record of her sojourn to Thriving Fortune and her return. And after that, nothing. Before Kazu disappeared, she sends tons of fortune tellers to the empress. Three of them become essential to Inyo's plans. The fortune tellers travel to the capital and beyond as spies. The first, Zhang Fuang, whose son was killed by imperial guards, and his wife becomes a kingfisher in her grief. Zhang is a favourite among the aristocratic families in the capital. He spies on these powerful families and persuades some of them to change sides when the time comes. One time, Mei is a drover's daughter. She tells fortunes by feeling people's skulls and pickpocketing their pockets at the same time. And lastly, there is Sukai, a merry, mischievous, migratory and royal loyal man who knows all the back roads and takes them to go north to convey coded messages back and fro. At first, Rabbit is irritated by Sukai, but soon she falls in love with him. Inu manipulates and sidesteps the Minister of the Left and the Imperial spies by openly embracing fortune-telling and its paraphernalia. Chet and Almost Brilliant find carefully stored astrology charts, hundreds and hundreds of them. Initially, Chet think they're just bad copies of the charts all village fortune-tellers carry. Rabbit tells Chet to take a closer look. Each chart is a little bit different, and the movements of the stars are actually a code. The fortune-telling lucky sticks also carry a secret linguistic code. Inyo and her relatives in the north communicated openly about battle plans and strategy through these visible and yet invisible coded messages. Every year, Inyo's relatives send her a box of white salt, white for purity, stillness and innocence. However, one year, they send her a box of black salt. Iron gives the black salt its colour, red iron that comes from swords, shields and bells that are on mammoth bridles. Chet knows the black salt stands for something else, and Rabbit answers, "You do understand." Inu patiently plans a pilgrimage to the many sites honouring An's gods. All her predecessors have made the same pilgrimage. The Minister of the Left knows something's up. He tries to stop Inu from going. She refuses. He cannot stop her, but he's angry. The minister notices Sukai among the household servants and questions him. He asks to take Sukai with him. Inu pretends indifference to Sukai, pretends he's nothing to her, just a lowly servant. Sukai has no choice but to go with the Minister of the Left. A scared and angry Rabbit tells Inu, "You could have kept him here with us." Inu is sad and tells Rabbit that she is sorry. She could have kept Sukai, but as she tells Rabbit, it might cost me something else. Inu, Rabbit, and the remaining two fortune tellers and a whole baggage of imperial attendants start the pilgrimage. As they travel across the kingdom, they are assessing the strength of the empire, its troops, its fortification, and the weather marshes. Basically, the pilgrimage is just a big reconnaissance mission. At each site, as dictated by custom, Inu releases massive amounts of doves for the people's pleasure. Among the doves are homing doves, bred by Wan Tai Mei. They fly home to the north carrying information tied on their legs for Inu's family and generals. Along the journey, Inu makes herself disagreeable and fires all her attendants and guards and other support staff, and hires her own disguised northern soldiers as substitute. Rabbit finds out that she's pregnant with Sukai's child. It nearly breaks her. After nearly a year away, the group return back to Scarlet Lake and thriving fortune. The Minister of the Left sends a present to Inu, Sukai's body in a leather bucket. Inu doesn't let Rabbit look inside the bucket. The weather begins to change. Remember, it's been summer for 60 years. Winter and snow come. Inu is rejuvenated, breathing in gushing handfuls of the cold air. The Minister of the Left comes to take Inu back to the capital, perhaps to make her disappear along the way. However, he and the Imperial soldiers find themselves surrounded by the disguised Northern soldiers. The Minister asks to be allowed to commit suicide rather than be killed by the soldiers. Inu lets Rabbit make the final decision. Rabbit doesn't care how he dies, as long as he's dead. As she says on page 111, "There's something I think peasants understand better than nobles. For them, the way down matters. Whether you get skewered by a dozen guardsmen, or thrown in a silk sack, or drown, or allowed to remove your robe and walk down to the shores of the lake before you gut yourself, peasants understand that dead is dead." Inyo keeps the Minister of Left's imperial gown as a trophy. The north begins to attack the south. nuns come to give Sukai a ceremonial burial and Rabbit goes into labour. Page 112. I went into labour 4 weeks after we returned to Thriving Fortune. I began at dusk and Inyo barred everyone from the chambers except herself and Mai. They hung a rope from the rafters that I pulled on when the pain was too great, and at dawn, with me delirious and half insensible, a girl was born. "Are you sure?" asked Inyo, and I nodded. She and Mai cleaned me and the child, and while I slept, Inyo carried the baby out into the world, her daughter born of a miracle. There is a story on the books of the Emperor of An coming to Inyo in a dream and pressing a seed into her belly. It is the story that the people of An like a great deal, about the great vitality of their rulers and how they reach out in their sleep or in death, and it isn't as if the history books aren't full of such things. When a little princess in her arms and the mammoth god of the north at her back, Inyo returned to the capital, and what happens next is a matter of record. She took the city with a minimum of bloodshed, and the Emperor Sung killed himself, or perhaps was killed by nobles who did not wish to see the dynasty humiliated. The crown prince was spirited away, the prince in exile, until his own keepers killed him some years later. Inyo dealt as fairly as she could, was ruthless when she had to be, and the day after the eclipse of 359, which historians call the end of the Su dynasty, she was crowned the Empress of Salt and Fortune, the ruler of An and the sister of the North. The North took the South, and 60 years later, here we all are. The story is over. Do you understand? I think I do, Dowager Empress. Slowly Che knelt in front of Rabbit, pressing their forehead against the dusty wood. Oh, stop that now at once, Rabbit said. If you knew anything, you know why you must not do that. Che sat up again, nodding. I wanted to show you that I do understand. Honour is due to you as the mother of the Empress of Wheat and Flood, and honour is due to you as the friend of the Empress of Salt and Fortune. Look to your records, cleric. Honour is a light that brings trouble. Shadows are far safer. Che dreamed that night of a young woman in servant's clothing walking through the dim halls of Thriving Fortune. As she went, she tidied the already tidy house, straightening a vase here, letting out a moth there. She looked around the compound with a sense of affection and nostalgia. But as she went outside and around to the north side of the house, her step quickened. There was a young man waiting for her, leaning against a pile of rocks and tapping his foot in mock impatience. He was tall with gangly limbs and a face slightly out of true. Well, there you are, Rabbit. I thought rabbits were meant to be fast, but look how slow you are. Huh, like you're worth hurrying for. Don't flatter yourself. I was having a fine time in the capital. In Che's dreams, the moon had set, leaving the star path traversed by the dead bright in the sky. The two of them looked up at it for a moment, and then they started to laugh, shaking their head at the strangeness of the world, pain long behind them. Well, shall we? Asked the young man, and Rabbit shrugged. I hope the cleric locks up the house tightly after they go, but that's a small thing. Let's go. They started to walk, rising as they did so, and from the porch over the lake, Che watched them fade into two stars that shone just above the horizon. Che wakes up the next morning to find Rabbit gone. Che and Almost Brilliant proceed onto the capital for the new Empress's first dragon court. They know that she will be fierce enough to fight wolves. I loved this book. In fact, I loved it so much, I read it twice. I've not encountered any of Vo's material before, but I'll be tracking all of her stuff down. The Empress of Salt and Fortune is concise and written in a minimalistic and stylized manner. It's a subdued, subtle and powerful fantasy. You won't find any gory deaths or extended or purple prose, and there are no fight scenes. It's not necessary what Rabbit says, what Vo writes, what Chet hears. It's more what's implied, what is left unsaid, that give this story its heft. Vo's storytelling is uncommon. She and Rabbit trust Che and the reader to interpret and decipher what's going on. Basically, Rabbit's gentle, "Do you understand?" is not only to Che, but to the reader too. I also like not being bashed over the head with what I was supposed to understand or think about the story. The tale is told through not just the history of people, but the history and symbolism of objects as well. Initially, I didn't understand why each chapter began with that short description of the items Che locates at the Thriving Fortune, but pretty soon I started to guess how the story and Inyo would incorporate them. There's the symbolism of the black salt, north and south, the hair-wrapped bundle, the kingfisher, and on. Things have multiple meanings in this story. What surprised me was the rich complexity of the characters. In such a short book, the characters didn't feel like cardboard cutouts, flat or lifeless. They're not all good or all bad, but are wholly multidimensional. And that's a really rare find, and as I said, in such a short book. As Rabbit tells Che, Inyo was romantic, terrible, glamorous, and sometimes all three at once. And you can really see that in that characterization. And in Rabbit's characterization, her voice when she's young lends that sense of awe and freshness. And when she's telling the story at the end, there is that matureness in her tone. You can literally feel Inyo thinking and weighing up consequences of putting up a fuss about Sukai and Kuzu with the Minister of the Left. You really feel as if you've known the characters forever, even Almost Brilliant. I felt as if I knew Kuzu, a girl who was fun, mischievous, and had a huge zest for life, even though she was in the story just for a couple of pages. I was also left wanting to know Che's backstory, how they became a monk, what drew them to their calling. Maybe that's Fo's next story. The Empress of Salt and Fortune examines how patriarchal societies pass over and dehumanize women, minorities, and the poor. The women in the harem, the accessory wives, the concubines, are all exchangeable and not to be concerned over. They are punished with exile, death, vanished with no recourse open to them. Rabbit is seen as a commodity, literally being sent in place of missing tax items. The women and the poor should be quiet and unseen, like the massed palace servants, unless the patriarchal society demands they step forward. What I loved about the Empress of Salt and Fortune, and this speaks to the book Uppity Women too, is how all these forgotten people are able to use and bend the power structure with clever and very subversive tactics to get what they want. Inyo and her plan to go undetected, because she is a woman, because she associates herself with low-class frivolities and low-class people. It's this underestimation, this passing over, that allows Inyo to be a general in plain sight, planning missions, battles, and an imperial overthrow, using other and underestimated and overlooked people as soldiers and weapons. I just love that. I especially liked the exploration of the bonds and the support that women create and find with each other. Even though Rabbit loves Sukai, it's her bond with Inyo that's the most prominent in her life and at the heart of the Empress of Salt and Fortune. Here are some book club questions. Inyo's prime job was to have a baby. Is reproduction still the prime job for women in our society today? Who are your closest female friends? What bonds do you share with them and why? Rabbit tells Che, wars are won by silenced and nameless women. And Rabbit is told that angry mothers raise daughters fierce enough to fight wolves. What do you think this means? Who collects and writes history in our society? And does it really matter who writes the history? Che tells Rabbit that if a record cannot be perfect, it should at least be present. Better for it to exist than for it to be perfect and only in your mind. Do you agree? Rabbit tells Che that in Inyu's eyes, she could see the watching spirits of Inyu's dead kin, who would only send their women to the south only as weapons. So do you think it was in Inyu and the south's plan to remove the emperor from the very start? Other books by Nevo are The Chosen and The Beautiful, and When the Tiger Came Down the Mountain. I hope you get a chance to read and reread The Empress of Salt and Fortune. Bye-bye.